I have some spinach in my teeth. Is that a problem?
Evening. Hi, this is Char Harden with charhardenblogspot.com. Actually, I've done that wrong, so orgy.
You don't think I would know? Yet. I love it. Remember my prediction that, this was going to spiral into chaos immediately? We haven't even started it yet. And
I was going to recommend a little more scotch there, Char.
I'm actually having a cherry limeade.
Oh, I love cherry lime, Ricky. But is that alcoholic or what?
No, it's a cherry limeade.
I have that actually in my indie chick flick. I have the cherry lime Ricky. And the question is, well, what? Lime, it's called a lime Ricky in Brooklyn. And they're like, the girl's from out of New York. She says, why is it red if it's lime?
Incidentally, when you guys called, I was looking through a book on of absinthe cocktails. So I was planning on drinking. But it's okay. We'll get started anyway.
Okay. All right, here, I'm serious. Good evening. Hi, this is Char. I'm here tonight with Stephen Gladstone.
Hi.
Mr. Joe Randazzo.
Hey.
And Mr. Joe Randazzo.
I'm trying to not crack up.
You're allowed. You can do that. Orgies and all.
Oh, man. This is going to be fun. I can tell already.
Didn't anybody warn you that I'm crazy?
I think Stephen warned you that I am, and then you kind of told him, well, I can handle him.
Hold on, guys. I got to make the hot tub a little warmer now. Okay, thank you. I'm back.
Ooh, and Mrs. Gladstone's right there, correct?
No, she's locked in the other room watching TV while I do this.
You lock her in the other room. What was that we were saying prior to the show? How I love my wife and my children are awesome. And he locked his wife in the room. I love it. Yeah, and mine's somewhere in the bayous.
My wife's a serious journalist who now works for Reuters, although she used to cover the film business. And so, you know, she's sort of like, I can't read your horror films. Sorry. It's like, okay.
Cool. I can read your horror films. Actually, I did rewatch Hellion, and I did read The Resurrection of Blake House, and I almost finished Ripper. I'm sorry, but I didn't finish it, Joe. But I liked it.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you not finishing it was meant to be an insult or not. Like, God, it's fucking terrible. I just threw it aside.
No. It's not terrible at all. That's the thing. I was looking at both of them. And they are both fast-paced, and after probably the first maybe 15 pages, I forgot I was reading in like script form, which is good because I've read others and I just couldn't wait to get through them.
Okay.
These are really good, and fast-paced, great, awesome, and they were engrossing. And as I got closer to the end on Blake House, my heart started pounding. I was like, oh. So that's very good. Because normally, if I can't get past the format of it and picture it in my head, then it fucking doesn't get read. It gets pitched. I don't have time to sit and be bored. So, but I was not bored with either of those. And I'm like maybe 10, 15 pages from finishing Ripper.
Oh, all right, cool.
But I'm not disappointed at all. I was like, when I realized what time it was from work, I had to leave. I said, I got to get home and cook dinner and everything. And I said, crap, I was about 30 pages from being finished. But I didn't want to rush it. It's like wine. I want to savor it.
It's interesting. I had an impromptu interview a couple nights ago about it. from someone else was going to be interviewing Steven and I, but she wanted to talk to me about Ripper first. And the comment that I got was that she was shocked that it wasn't. Excuse me, got a little bit of a cough. The comment that I got from her was that she was shocked that it wasn't like this massive bloody thing that she had apparently imagined it to be. So I guess it's just compliments all around right now for it. So that's pretty cool.
Oh yeah, like more like a thriller is what it kind of felt like.
Yeah, I guess it was. Yeah, it was kind of written that way. I kind of put the murders in the background, and I, you know, amazingly, I didn't get as much flack for that as I did, you know, as Steven and I did for Playcast. We'll get to that eventually.
The thing on the Ripper where he's doing his slicing and dicing, I can hear it in my head. That's good.
Yeah, because I described sound more than I described the visual, because I kind of felt that would be a little bit more more appropriate. I kind of thought to myself, if you've ever seen Mark Robeson's The Body Snatcher, the 1945 mm-hmm. movie of Boris Karloff, back then you couldn't show it, so a lot of the stuff had to be implied, and right. One of my favorite sequences is the girl that's singing as she's walking through the town. She's this poor blind girl who's always begging for change, and she's constantly singing this song, and at one point the doctor, played by Henry Daniell, meets a body, but for whatever reason, I don't remember, Karloff couldn't go get a corpse, so he waits around the corner for her, and she's just singing as she walks down the alley. And then out of nowhere, she's just silenced, like mid-sentence. And I always thought that kind of using sound that way and not showing viscerally what happened can be a little bit more terrifying sometimes. And I thought the idea that you just hear this knife just slicing through things, and you just hear the steel against concrete, like he's just digging right through her, I thought would really be... would really be in many ways more terrifying than just sitting there describing exactly what he's doing to the organs.
Right. I thought so too. Thought it was very well written.
You know, it's funny. I was talking when we were in, New Jersey for Terror Fest, mm-hmm. I was talking with Carlo Rodriguez. Remember he did the, Psycho. What was the name of the film? Psycho. Bloodbath.
I don't remember, but it was, Psycho Killer Bloodbath.
Psycho. Right. So, we were talking, we were having breakfast, we were talking about how, you know, on the internet, I was like, what can you do with a horror film now? Because on the internet, there's nothing you can't see.
Right.
There's
right.
no shock value. There's nothing that you're going to go to watch a horror movie and that you've never seen before or you can't see somewhere else that's going to scare you. So being able to, like, hear it, and I'm a image guy, but the sound, you know, what you can do with the sound, that can really... You know, in Hellion, I think one of those scenes that, you know, some people really laugh at it and some people cringe, but when you hear the staples going into the kid's head.
I know. I was like, oh my God. Jesus. You can almost feel it, not just hear it. It's like, God. I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's.
That curls
my toes.
Steve
and I were discussing it on the way to Philadelphia. It is the most cringe inducing moment in his film, and it's brilliant because it's the sound. Not the visual that gets you.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
No. Oh, I highly agree. The toes are curled. Just thinking about it. Oh, God. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, good.
Yep. Now, out of 16, yes, what did I say? 1,635 short films, I remember the staples going in that kid's head.
And that's
a good thing.
It was a good thing, and he was really good about it because we had forgotten to take the staples out of the stapler when we.
Oh wow! I wondered what he thought because it was.
No, I'm kidding. Actually,
yeah.
He's my nephew, and I promised not to damage him very much. So we did take the staples out.
Oopsie.
Sorry, sis. Well, you have four more. It's...
Sorry. Oh my gosh. Let's see. So how did you guys meet?
Oh,
You want to tell that, Steven? Because you tell it more colorfully because you thought I was an asshole.
I've heard that about you. Are you an asshole, Joe?
Some people think so.
I don't know.
I was shooting
Mike
some
Young, so go ahead.
I was shooting a student film. That's cool. I was shooting a student film for, I guess we should give him his name, Joe Buckley.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe was PAing on it, and Joe just had all this enthusiasm and planning, and I just thought, well, here's somebody who's like really into the concept of making a movie, but he's never going to make a movie. He will, you know, Joe's not ever going to be anywhere. I really thought Joe would never be anywhere in the film business because, you know, I'm sort of this arrogant guy thinking I've been working in the business forever and blah, blah. But and, you know, turns out that Joe is really good on set, but he's an amazingly talented writer. And when you read what he's written, it's just obvious and there and clear, and there's never a what moment. So that's how we met, and then Joe knew some other people, and through him I made some friends and shot films for them, and I shot a film for Joe, and then we started talking, and he told me about his Ripper project, and I said, you know, I have this idea for a horror film. And the problem is I really kind of am weak on the horror aspect, and I know that this is what you sort of eat, live, breathe, and crap. So, you know, what do you feel about writing together? Because I find it hard to write by myself. And Joe's turned out to be an amazing writing partner.
Well, at the same time, the source material was really good because excuse me. Steven had sent me this, 12 or 15 page short that he'd written called Contractor Special. Mm-hmm. And what I would do is back then, I was taking my now late father, I was taking him to dialysis every morning, and I'd have to get up at 4 a.m. and take him down there. And I'd usually wait around, grab breakfast, so I printed it out and I took it with me, and I was reading it over breakfast, and I read it like two or three times. I remember it kind of reminded me of, like, the old EC comics, like Tales from the Crypt and stuff, because it really was kind of a morality tale in a way. And I called him back and I told him, look, I'd love to do it. You know, it had a nice little twist ending. So I told him I was on Ripper, which at that time was supposed to be for a low-budget company based out of New Jersey that it was going to be directed by a couple of friends of mine. It was going to be done for like a very small, minuscule amount of money. And then they eventually dropped us anyway. They wanted something a little bit more exploitative. Mm-hmm. But what I turned in was nothing like that. So I told them I got to finish this thing for them first. And then, you know, we'll do Contractor Special together. And a couple weeks later, I finished it up. We met, we threw around some ideas. And, I brought my own ideas to the table, and honestly, I thought I was going through so much during that time because Ripper had started making its way through a lot of festivals and winning a lot of awards, and I was flying all over the country, and a lot of things happened in my personal life that made me unable to do as much as I could have on it. But I wrote the first draft, and Steven picked up from there, and we'd trade drafts back and forth. And eventually, a couple months ago, he sent it to me, and I told him, you know what, I think it's ready as it is. I think it's fine. But honestly, he credits me a lot as being a good co-writer. I don't think I was on this project. I think he deserves most of the credit for any of the good that's in Blake House. But it was fun. It was a fun experience, and we're working on something else now. And again, my life is in turmoil because I'm selling the house in New York and moving out to LA. So I haven't been able to focus as much as I should have, but, he's very kind to say that about me. I'll leave it at that. And it's been great working with Steven too.
awesome. So now when are y'all going to tell me the real stuff? All this nice stuff is gushy. I'm joking. Y'all were so quiet. I wish I could see your face.
Okay, so here's what it's like working with Joe. It's funny because it works both ways because, you know, when he was doing Ripper, he would run some things by me. He would say, I'm kind of stuck, blah, blah, blah. And I would then do the same thing without realizing it on Blake House. When we were talking, you know, on his – one of us would be talking. It's like sort of in the stereotypical marriage where someone would say, well, here's my problem. What do you think? Here's what I want to do. And then that person would just talk through it. No, wait, sorry. Got that wrong.
Orgy,
right. So you would talk. So you'd say to the other person, okay, what do you think? Here's what I'm thinking. The other person would say, "I have, here's a great idea. Blah, 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 blah." And you're listening on the phone and you go, no, but now I know what to do. Thanks.
Bye.
And there would be ideas.
Yes, very much.
That sounds like a marriage.
And then you go, you know what? I have a really stupid idea. I throw it away. Don't even use it. And then the person would say, no, that's the one I'm going to use. It's brilliant. So in a way, it's sort of like being married.
Uh-huh.
You just sort of have that comfort level where you can just say what you need to say and hear it or hear someone else talk and have no fear of saying to them, no, I really hate that idea, but I have a much better one.
Cool. And then your idea actually worked for whatever he's working on.
Yeah, it's kind
of... There were a lot of situations where I'd come up with something and I'd call Steve and I'd be like, I got this brilliant idea. Then I'd say it out loud and I'd be like, wow, I didn't realize how stupid it sounded until I said it out loud and he'd agree with me and I'd just drop it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, Joe was, you know, when it's funny because in the writing process, you know, when it's yours, it, you know, so Joe is like Blake House is mine. And so, you know, Joe is like, okay, Steve's really the driving force. And I love that. Great. I'm not going to argue. But you get into this point where you get stuck and you know you need something and you can't do it. And so I was talking with Joe. I said, I need to have this, the MacGuffin, to make this thing work. And I've been thinking about it for like 2 weeks and I can't come up with it. And Joe was cleaning up and getting ready to, you know, he's working to sell his house. He's going through his stuff. And he saw his father's watch on the table. And he goes, well, why don't we just have it be the girl's father's watch?
Cool.
And it was like, oh, my God, that's like absolutely perfect. And I'm so wrapped up into it, I'll never see it. And then for Joe, it's just, you know, he's got that little bit of space that he can just, you know, go, boom. Okay, yeah, this is obvious and simple. And so as far as the writing process goes, I think it's nice it works both ways. When Joe is the driving force on his pieces, you know, if I'm on the outside a little, I'm not as wrapped up and into it. I can see something that's harder for the guy whose baby it is, so to speak,
right,
to see.
Exactly, because I think Ripper would not have been anywhere near as good had Steven not read over it several times and been like, you know, I think this here doesn't work. And he pointed out to me. And although I don't have an actual co-writer on Ripper, Steven, in many ways, was very important to the way it came about or became what it is, because he would often tell me when something wasn't working or when he felt something wasn't clear enough or was missing. And that would make me go back in and put it in. I mean, there were times where I completely disagreed with him, but Steven, again, kind of saw it as, okay, Ripper's your baby, Blake House is mine. You know, I think ultimately we both saw where we stood on each project.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a healthy relationship in that way, because we both knew not to step on each other's toes on either project.
Right, but on Blake House...
We both kind of had a vision and auteured it. Ripper was mine, Blake House was his, and I still tell people when they ask me about Blake House, it's a lot of the... just about everything that's good in there was Steven's, because it really was his vision. I just helped out with it.
Right, but, you know, Joe, I'll tell you, Ripper was completely written several times before I ever even saw a draft, And all I did was talk about what might be better, was weak, was not as strong. But with Blake House, it was a matter of, here's my idea, Joe, I can't get started. And Joe wrote like 70 pages and wrote me and says, here it is, and it sucks. And then I read it and I went, okay, yeah. And then I wrote another, I cleaned it up what I wanted, wrote 15 more pages, sent it back to Joe, and so on. That's how it went forth until we finished with it. Mm-hmm. And then we were like,
I think first drafts always suck.
Yeah, so
I think the first drafts always suck.
Yeah, well, everything. You know, I think anything before draft 5 probably sucks. So,
yeah.
You know, so that's just, but, you know, so there was a big difference in it. And so Joe really, whereas, you know, I gave advice and input onto Ripper. That's Joe's. And I don't need any kind of shared writer's credit because I didn't do any real writing on it. It was, you know, Joe, Blake House, Joe gets, you know, that the share of the writer credit.
Cool.
I wasn't on that from the very beginning.
Yeah. No,
Ripper was on my draft like 3 to 4 before you even looked at it.
Yeah, well. No, I liked Ripper. It was great. But, you know, this is too much fun and love. We have to get into some ugliness. Otherwise, no one will listen to the podcast.
Well, then screw them. I'll listen to their podcast. God dog it. I was curious on the, like, that maybe, let's see, how did I put this? Did you find any similarities between the new popular American Horror Story and Blake House? Because I kind of picked up on a couple.
You know, it's funny. Somebody else asked me that at Terror Fest. As far as I'm concerned, no. I mean, it's, in a sense, it's a haunted house, mm-hmm. and they're both haunted houses. But they're really, you know, American Horror, I in many ways I like, and some things I just, one thing that's just a pet peeve on me is that they just take chunks of music from Vertigo or
mm-hmm.
or Horror, and they just play them. It's like, okay, I want you to feel this now, so we're going to play this music to make sure that you understand what you're supposed to feel. And it's just, you know, this is not inspired. This is not auteur. This is I'm sort of ripping off somebody else's work here to make you to because I'm not doing it. I'm failing.
Because I'm not doing it. I'm not getting my point across without having to sample something else.
Right. So I'm failing at this point. And it's a pity because a lot of the show is really very good, but it's, I'm wondering where they're going and how they're going to get there. Cause you know, it's kind of,
I'm lost. I'm two episodes behind.
Well, I won't interesting twist. And there's some things I'm just like, okay, that's too far beyond. Sorry. That's zombies running and zombies physically. It's a physical impossibility for zombies to run.
Right.
That's one of Joe's arguments. It's like, okay, that is too far and beyond that I don't like. You know, an American Horror Show, Horror Story. But I don't see that many similarities, truthfully.
The only thing that I really did, other than, yeah, they're both haunted houses, that the houses are characters, kind of. Blake House actually becomes a character to me. And then the American Horror Story's house actually becomes like a character itself.
I like that.
It becomes more, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Joe.
I was going to say, I think that comes more from just, I think the best haunted house stories, the actual house usually is kind of like a character. When you think of The Changeling and all those mm-hmm. films. I honestly, we wrote this, when did American Horror Story come out? I think it's this year.
Yeah, this year.
I haven't seen, yeah, I mean, when did we start sending this out? Like April or May? I don't even think...
Right.
The show even started airing yet. I still to this day haven't seen an episode of it. I actually gave up on TV and modern movies a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen a single episode of it. I think if anything, if there's any inspiration in Blake House, to me it was a lot of the older haunted house movies that I grew up watching.
Yeah, I agree.
It's funny, this idea of, like, the house as a character. I remember seeing, you know, hearing people talk about Taxi Driver, and they said, well, you know, really, the cab is a character in this movie. And I've watched Taxi Driver, and it's great film and great filmmaking, and to this day I don't understand how the cab is a character, and I don't quite connect
with that. And people who try to sound smart.
But I don't connect with, like, you know, the house itself is just a house. There's a spirit inhabiting it, and you know, that spirit has a very particular sort of bent of who it wants to take advantage of, who it wants to get revenge upon.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to say, well, the spirit and the house are sort of are coexistent together, because, you know, the house could be like the battery that holds the malevolent spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but really, I look at it as the spirit is its own entity. It's like, I live in my apartment, and yes, the apartment's a reflection of me, but the apartment isn't a character in my life. It's just a space I inhabit.
Gotcha.
Well, I think in the last year, I kind of saw how a structure could become kind of a character in your life, because I went through, you know, Stephen knows this, I went through a lot of loss in a very short time. Mm-hmm. So to me, the whole thing about getting the hell out of New York was really about getting away from the house, where everywhere I turned there was a memory of something and somebody that's never coming back. So I kind of understand how a structure could become almost like a being in that way, because the house, while not, you know, not going with the, you know, there were no ghosts or anything, the house in many ways was haunting me. And it was mainly because everything around me had been there through better times, and I'm just glad I didn't have to end up spending the holidays in it this year, to be honest, because I mean that would have just been torture. But I could absolutely understand how an inanimate structure could become kind of a source of strife and pain because of that. So in a way, I can kind of understand it, and it's kind of an old thing. I mean, it's been in horror movies for a long time. If you look at something like the original Haunting, or The Legend of Hell House.
Hell House.
You know, you have the structure itself. There is a part of everything. It's the atmosphere that it kind of projects. I don't agree with it in Taxi Driver that the cab was a character, but
no.
I think it's very true in the case of horror movies. I think it's important. I think the structure of the house, when you're doing a haunted house movie, I think you should really lay it out, and I think you should really know where everything is, because I think it becomes important.
All right. Another thing, I was confused.
I hope that made sense.
It did. It made perfect sense.
I love Legend of
the House. I did too. The diner, was it haunted as well? Am I reading that right?
The diner, you can say yes. The diner's a real structure.
Right.
And Mildred.
Right.
You know, Mildred / Mrs. Blake sort of inhabits that diner. But it's a real structure.
Real.
And there is a little playing fast and loose in one scene, because the diner is really closed, but it's open for just this one character to exist. You know, it's open for one interaction on this character. And I'm fine with that, because by that point in the script, the ghost is activated. So the ghost can go, and the malevolent spirit is activated, and it goes and insinuates itself throughout its environs, which is beyond the house, to further its needs and to further its end. You know, one of the things that I really dislike in a bunch of horror movies, and, you know, for example, The House on Haunted Hill, is there's these spirits, the remake of House on Haunted Hill, the spirit that's just always active. And for some reason, and it makes no sense, it just picks a moment to start interacting with the real world. But why? It's as if it's omniscient. Mm-hmm. And it's so, you know, if you want to create revenge on someone, why orchestrate making it all happen at once and bringing them all together? So waiting for an event where you can orchestrate that. If you really want revenge and you're an active spirit, just go kill people. Go take your revenge. It doesn't. It to me, it's like it's a failing when there's no rhyme or reason for the spirit to suddenly start to take action.
Right.
Yeah, something should trigger it. I agree with that.
You know, and like Poltergeist, which I don't know if you call that a horror film, but you know,
yeah.
there is this triggering thing that starts. You know, that they've invaded the graveyard,
mm-hmm.
and then if you want to say that the certain age of the little girl, or maybe it's just the spirits are enough. We've got all these houses going, and you know, I'm fine with that sort of. You know, that has sort of a very slow and triggering event, which we don't ask about,
mm-hmm.
but it's kind of obvious that something has gone on, and you know, even Craig T. Nelson says it, he's like, well, I guess they'd be okay if the body's removed, you know, and then you find out they weren't. It's like, okay, you know, it could have been the digging up of the pool that triggered everybody.
Yeah, they say usually that small children are more susceptible to the spirits. I think that's why her age played into it the way it did.
Right. Although I don't know who they are. I'd like to meet they one day.
Just in reading, I've read stuff over the years where the authors of different haunted stories and this and that have all said the children of that young of age are more susceptible.
It's
and animals.
That young of age also have a much more overactive imagination.
Mm-hmm. And then when you see them talking to nothing, you just think it's their imaginary friend. And the spirits are like, ha-ha, you dumbasses. You think you're so smart because you're adults. This child's smarter than you are because she can see me.
This child is not.
There's actually one movie that did that really, really well, and it was in the 40s. It was Curse of the Cat People.
Yes.
Where there was that great, great, great scene where... you know, the little girl supposedly has an imaginary friend, and she finds a picture of her father's first wife, and who's her, I believe, her actual mother. It's been years since I've seen it, so I don't remember. I believe it's her actual mother, and she died at the end of the first movie. So now, when she finds a picture of the first wife in the father's drawer, she asks, who is that? And the father responds, and she says something about how, I don't remember what the line was, but I remember it was bone-chilling to hear that, you know, oh, this is my friend, she comes to see me every night. And if I remember correctly, in the very next scene, you see her in her room with the first wife. Ah, you know what, Orgy, cut that out, because I don't remember it enough. I shouldn't have told the story if I don't remember it enough.
I can't remember. I can see just... Orgy. I can just about remember it, but I can't quite get to the. Cause I know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
I'm
forgetting it now. It's been like 10 years since I've seen it, but I remember really, really loving it, and I remember that kind of was. That I was kind of reminded of that with what we were just talking about. But back on Peso, I think a lot of it is that children have more overactive imagination. When it comes to ghosts, there's two questions that I have immediately. Well, you know what? No, let's make it three questions that I have immediately. A, if ghosts have been around forever, how come there's no caveman ghosts? Why do they seem to start around, like, the 19th century?
Really?
Why are they not naked? Why isn't every ghost you've ever seen naked? Surely the clothes can't be haunted. And three, why is it that if a ghost can walk through a wall and walk through a door, they don't fall through the floor?
Hello.
You know, actually, I can answer that because, you know, if you look at a lot of cultures, you know, Native American cultures, for example, they discuss ancestors and being guided by the ancestors. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there have been the sense of spirits, but just the terms of the application of the spirits is probably changed within that time frame you're talking about, the last 200, 300
years. Well, in the
Western
world, I mean, I know in Japan and China. In Japan and China, the ghosts go back centuries and centuries. But I'm just saying, here in the United States and in England and in Europe, they don't really exist before, you know, maybe at earliest, the 18th century is probably the oldest ghost we could think of. You know, 17th or 18th century. You know,
I don't know. I think back to Henry VIII period. You know, there are, you know, the ghosts that haunt the tower.
Right.
I think, you know, it may be a function of the age of, you know, the like the lifespan of a culture, you know, how it may change. You know, they're always, you know, ancestors are always referenced, and then the haunting sort of thing. Yeah, it doesn't really seem to pick up in Europe or America until a few hundred years ago. But who knows? As far as ghosts being clothed, you have Casper and his cousins or whatever the hell they were to him, who were just like big white sheets. And, you know, and I don't have a problem with ghosts not falling through the floor. I really don't, unless they're intending to do so.
I mean, if we accept the idea that a ghost is just an image. Am I echoing here?
It's okay.
You had a dropout for a moment, Joe.
Oh, did I? All right. Well, what I was saying was that oh shit! What was I saying?
Ghosts.
Somebody had an image.
I think if we accept the fact that a ghost is an image that's trapped in its surroundings, kind of like a photograph, then yeah, I think in that case we can, you know, I think that's a case that we can make scientifically for it. I don't know if it's necessarily a trapped soul, but I think there can be something said about an image being caught somewhere. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the scientific credentials to say whether or not that's true, but as a very devout atheist, I don't really believe in ghosts.
No.
But I am fascinated by them, and they scare the shit out of me. I'm scared of the idea that a ghost can exist. I just don't believe they do.
I'm actually going to go with Joe on that, because I have been, you know, I've traveled a bit, mostly for work, And I cannot say that I've actually ever seen a ghost, or, you know, felt the presence of a ghost, or you know, nothing has floated up in the, you know, unexplainable has ever really happened. You know, about the scaredest I've ever been of a location was in Prague, or near Prague in Terezin, and near where they had the camp where they had the ovens, although it really wasn't a death camp. It was very creepy because there was an old hearse in there, a horse-drawn hearse. And,
oh, wow.
And it was absolutely terrifying at one point for me to be in this sort of bunker. And, you know, there are these grills, these big iron gates blocking off these two passages. And I'm sitting there with my 16-millimeter camera changing film, because I want to shoot this, and I have to put in this really fast film, and there's suddenly this wind is coming up these tunnels, and it's getting slowly more and more forceful, the wind, and my heart's just beating, and I shot the footage, and then I just basically ran the hell out of there, scared out of my, it's about as scared as I've ever been, but as far as like a ghost, or is that just my mind playing tricks on me, you know, I've never really experienced a ghost.
We had one, we think, in the our bookstore, in our old location. There was it was in an old warehouse, basically. And on this particular day, there's maybe, I'm going to say, 30 people in there. And I was shelving, and I was walking back and forth in this little area. And up on a shelf in brown paper, like grocery bags, I had grab bags of books. And there was maybe we say 20, 25 books in a bag. They were the big bags. And the way they were stacked, I mean, nothing should have been able to knock them off unless somebody just walked by and just popped them. And I had walked back. Let's see, I had left Stephen King, was going back to science fiction. So I was walking back and forth in front of them. And it sounded like sandpaper going across the wood shelf. And then the next thing I know, it hits the floor. There's like a whoosh coldness that shoots past where I've just been, and it wrapped around into through the science fiction, and you hear people shit, damn, and there was all the way in the back. I mean, just like that, shit, damn, fuck. all the way in the back of the room, and everybody was talking about how cold it got. Now, in this warehouse, when the man built it, metal building, he didn't put in enough air condition, and this was like July. It was hot, and I've been told that it was cooler outside than it was in the warehouse, and we had two small units going and window units and fans. It was hot, and they were all these people were saying how cold it got, and then here that bag fell over, and it shouldn't have been able to. We had crap like that happen all the time.
I have a similar story too to that,
but I mean it's also the idea when I you know last May and then last July I traveled to Colorado to see a girl, and while we were there she's really into the whole ghost thing, and I'm a skeptic at heart. I don't believe in it, but if something happens I'm gonna have to believe my eyes. So her idea was, well, how about we stay in the hotel that's considered to be the most haunted hotel in Denver? So We headed up to the Oxford Hotel. I booked the room in advance, and I noticed you cannot book the infamous murder-suicide room, room 320, where some prospector, I think, married a woman, and he cheated on her that night, or she believed that he cheated on her. When he got back to the room, she killed him and then killed herself. So when we show up, you know, she and I are at the front desk checking in. They gave us, like, room, like, four, whatever. And I went, you know, to be perfectly honest, we really want to know if room 320 is available. Because that's supposedly the most haunted room in the place. So we, you know, the people are like, you know about room 320? I'm like, yeah, we know about room 320. We want room 320. It's the bridal suite. All right, well, yeah, we'll pay whatever it costs to get the bridal suite, but we want room 320. They sent us up there, and the whole night, you know, she and I are, you know, just kind of huddled close on, or cuddled on the couch, and, you know, she keeps saying, oh, do you hear that? Do you hear that? And you'd hear, like, faint things, like she'd say she hears, like, a faint scream, and I'm hearing something faint, too, but I don't know that it's a scream. It could be, you know, a parrot that somebody's got somewhere, or it could be a movie playing in another room, but you wonder, you know, it's like, oh, do you feel that chill? Do you feel that cold chill? And how much of that is that there's actual spirit activity in that room, and how much of it is that you're in a place where now when we asked for 320, they gave us a long list of things that supposedly have happened in that room. And they gave us a newspaper article from when the murder-suicide happened back in 1895, and supposedly the ghost of Florence pops up on the bed and starts screaming at the guy that he's a cheating louse and all this stuff. And you start to wonder how much of that now that we're hearing supposedly all this going on, and we're sitting there, we're scared shit. Our hair is the hair on my arm is standing on end as I'm like thinking about this while I'm there with her. And you wonder how much of this is actually going on, and how much of this is just my mind has conditioned myself to think this. Just like Steven's story, just like your story, where we knew the history going in, well, of course we're going to be scared shit. You know, we're convinced that there's something else there, whether we see it or not. And it was the same thing when we went to, what the fuck was it, the sanitarium in Louisville, Waverly Hills. Nothing happened. It was the most innocuous 2 hours of my life. I spent 2 hours walking around this old closed-down sanitarium looking at nothing but empty walls, and you know, Jenna's going, oh, my God, this is creepy. What the fuck is oh, yeah, you know, it's creepy that there's people that, you know, apparently suffered and died in these walls. And I think that there's some form of, there's something inside of you that kind of captures that. I think it's kind of, you understand the human misery of that kind of place. Mm-hmm. I think that's what does it more than anything else. And again, this goes back to the whole idea of a structure being a character in itself. You could kind of feel the strife. Like, you'd feel the strife of, you know, a character like Willy Loman. I think you can feel the strife of a structure that's been through a lot.
Right.
You know, I think what happens is, you know, and you use it in the movies, and we were talking about it earlier with sound, that the scariest monsters are the ones in the mind. Right. And the scariest thing that's your brain is just going to scare you more than anything else. And, you know, I'm not really afraid of the dark, But I'm really scared of what's in the dark that I can't see.
And it doesn't have to be,
it doesn't have to be a spirit, you know, but you know, if I have to, I would renovate houses, and so they have no power, and you're going into the basement, and I am nervous, tense, because there could be a homeless guy in there with a shovel, and you know, that's not supernatural, but that's a fear thing. And so you know, it's sort of that, although actually I am kind of really scared of the dark anyway, but it's like I'll go into the dark if I have to, but I'm always on edge and I'm always scared. And what's that noise and what's going on? And cause I don't know, I'm not safe anymore. I'm in an environment I'm not used to. And actually that's, you know, when you go into a movie, I mean, that's the difference between watching a movie in a theater, in a real theater with a group of people and watching a movie on your TV at home. Cause you know, when you're in the theater, and I blog about this, you're sitting in darkness and you've got two things going on. One is you're almost completely, you're surrounded by strangers. So you don't know who they are and what they're going to do. So you have this heightened sense of nervousness because what's going on? Is this guy a killer behind me? It's all in the subconscious. It's going. And on the other hand, you're almost completely anonymous, because if you're walking down the street and a piano actually falls on somebody and kills them, you're not going to laugh. But in a movie theater, you will. Because because you're anonymous. So, you know, in a movie theater and when you're watching a projected film, which is different than projected video, when you're watching projected film, half the time you're actually in complete darkness.
Right.
You don't even realize it, but the way the film goes and the projection rate and as it just happens, it gives your mind in that darkness time to work over the images and the sound and sort of dream. So you get into this different sort of sense. And if you're sitting at home watching TV, you can pause it. You can go to the bathroom, you get something to drink, and the lights are on. You know, I watched the Others on a TV in my apartment, and I had the hand on the light switch because I was like, I'm going to watch it with the lights off. And when I got scared, I flicked that light switch right back on.
I slept with a nightlight after watching that movie.
Yeah, that was
awesome. The Others is a great movie too.
Awesome.
And again, I don't believe in the ghost, but it's that movie the whole time had me going, holy shit, I believe. And that's what these things need to do.
And I love the twist. It was like, that's brilliant. Oh my gosh, that's absolutely, didn't really see it coming, and then I got it and it was great, and it was very satisfying and sad, but it was so terrifying.
And the daddy situation, the daddy coming and going, how creepy was that?
That
threw me.
Perfectly orchestrated horror movie, a perfectly orchestrated ghost story that we don't see that often anymore.
You don't,
you know that, and I really love that. But real quick, another story about being afraid of the dark. Back in New York, a lot of my friends, you know, for a good time on Halloween, they'd be like, "Oh, let's go to Old Seaview Hospital, this crumbled old hospital in Staten Island that's been shut down." Now, they would go, "Oh, you want to go?" "Yeah, I'll go during the day." Like, "Oh, wow, you afraid of the ghosts at night?" So I'm like, "No, asshole, because the third and fourth floor have pits that have crumbled into the floors beneath them. I'm not walking through a building with no electricity where the ground might not be 2 feet in front of me. It's just not happening. I'm not putting myself in that situation. It's got nothing about being afraid of ghosts. It's the idea that there's a pit there and I don't see it.
Right.
I'm going to fall down and break my fucking leg. Or there's a rusty nail somewhere and I'm going to end up losing my foot." Mm-hmm.
Staten Island itself is a very weird place, Staten Island. And there's actually a documentary about Cropsey.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up in Brooklyn, you know the story about the guy with the hook hand and like the two kids who are like making out in Lover's Lane,
right.
and they hear about the psycho who's released and you know, well, in growing up, that story, the name of the psycho was always Cropsey. And so it's Cropsey. And Cropsey apparently originates in Staten Island because of all the mental institutions that were there and active 20, 30 years ago. I'm not sure exactly when they were shut down, but there were a lot of mental institutions, big ones. And And so that's apparently where Cropsey comes from, and there's this documentary on it, which I thought would be really about the Cropsey story, but instead it's about the weirdness of Staten Island. Staten Island is a very odd place.
Well, remember, it was also Geraldo Rivera that shut one of those institutions down. Because he did, like, this huge expose on it.
Right.
But interestingly enough, there was a horror movie made based on Cropsey in the 80s, and the Weinsteins produced it. It's called The Burning. Jason Alexander's in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the Cropsey legend, supposedly. Not much of it, though.
It's Cropsey! Ah! Never remember that. That's scary. You know, I think part of what makes a horror film, successful, for example, is a lot of it tends to be the buzz about it, like The Others. I watched it because people said it was terrifying. I remember watching, you know, The Ring, the remake of The Ring, and people were, and I watched it with my wife and a couple of friends of ours, and we watched it. We were in Atlantic City during the winter in my in-law-to-be's house, and we watched it, and every few minutes, one of us would just freak out and run away and up the stairs. And, you know, I could watch it today and go, this is not scary at all. Yeah, the girl climbs out of the well. Big deal. But when we were there, we had that group dynamic, and it was cold and dark at night, and we had the lights down low, and everybody said how terrifying it was, and we all fed into that, and suddenly, you know, you just went. So it's kind of fun. I mean, I think we're losing that sort of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Movies used to be, I don't know why suddenly we're on movies, but movies used to be this big social thing. You know, bowling was big in America. It was a big social activity. Now we're losing that. And so when you get in the movie theater with a lot of people, it's this social activity and all these things are going on and it plays into you. When you sit and you watch it on the, you know, the internet, it's, yeah, so what? You're completely removed from it.
But it was like when Insidious blew up when it came out and everything. Saw it.
I still haven't seen that.
You got to see that. I saw it a few times in the theater, and then I went back and actually watched everybody watch it. I went all the way up to the top and sat in the upper left corner and watched them watch it. And it was funny because a lot of people were saying, oh, my girlfriend was screaming and all this kind of stuff. It was the guys that were the biggest wusses.
Really?
Turning their heads, grabbing their girlfriend's hair, and covering their eyes. I was like, look at this. This is, you guys have been reduced to wusses.
Well, Vincent Price, Boris Karloff, and Peter Lorre used to joke on set about how stupid these movies they were in. But mm-hmm. Vincent Price said it's a whole dynamic of going to the theater and you scream and then you laugh at yourself for being so fucking stupid that you're screaming at something that's happening on the screen.
I remember watching. Do you remember The Changeling?
Mm-hmm.